Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. In this episode, we bring you Colson Whitehead. It's a talk for Portland Arts and Lectures in 2008. Colson Whitehead was born and raised in Manhattan, and he attended Harvard and wrote for The Village Voice. His first novel, The Intuitionist, was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. Whitehead was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Los Angeles Times Fiction Award, and the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, John Henry Days. In 2002, he won the prestigious MacArthur Genius Fellowship. Whitehead's reviews, essays, and fiction have appeared in a number of publications, such as The New York Times, The New Yorker, New York Magazine, and Harper's. Join us now for Colson Whitehead here on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
So, howdy. I'd like to thank Portland Arts and Lectures for having me, and all you guys for coming out. It's really nice of you. I've been coming to Portland a lot lately, it seems. I was here 2 years ago for the book festival, and then last year I came and taught at the Tin House Writers Workshop, and I had such a great time. I'm coming back again this summer. So, I don't know, it's kind of nice coming out here, and I'm glad to be here tonight with you guys. I'm going to talk about how I got started writing, my journey, if you will, where I'm coming from, where I'm going, and I hope parts you'll find entertaining and perhaps edifying. I guess I should start at the beginning. I was born a poor black child. I remember the days sitting on my porch with my family, singing and dancing down in Mississippi. I was born and raised in Manhattan. I was a bit of a shut-in. I would have preferred to have been a sickly child, but didn't work out that way. I always like it when I read a biography of somebody, like Joyce or whatever, and it says, they were a sickly child, forced to retreat into a world of imagination. It sounds so wonderful. Instead, I just didn't like going outside. Other kids left their houses and did sports, played in the great outdoors. I like to stay inside, watching The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits. I read a lot of comics and science fiction, and I adored Stephen King. Writing Spider-Man or the X-Men seemed like the perfect kind of job when I grew up. If you were a writer, you could work from home. It seemed like a good gig. You didn't have to wear clothes or talk to other people, and you could just make up stuff all day. So until I got to college and started reading different kinds of fiction, more contemporary stuff, I wanted to write The Black Shining or The Black Salem's Lot. Basically, if you took like a Stephen King title and put the black in front of it, that's what I wanted to do. Eventually, I started hitting the highbrow stuff, and I liked the equivalency I saw between science fiction, fantasy, horror, and magic realism in Garcia Marquez, the absurdity of Beckett, and the mythical landscapes of Borges. To me, they played with the fantastic as much as any genre writer. And I think it helps that I found Beckett to be a form of high realism. A guy is buried up to his neck in sand and can't move. He has an itch on his leg he can't scratch. I think that seems about right. So I got to college and I considered myself a writer, but I didn't actually write anything. I wore black. I smoked cigarettes. But I didn't sit down and write until I was a sophomore, and I wrote two stories, two five-page epics that I used to try to get into creative writing classes. There wasn't a major, but there were electives, and I got rejected each time, and it was very depressing. Last week, I was trying to think of parodies of how I used to write back then, but each time I came up with a line, I kept thinking, that's kind of true. He walks alone in the darkness. I do kind of walk alone in the darkness. He struggled to breathe as the vast void of existence crushed him. It does get kind of hard to breathe sometimes when the vast void is crushing you to this day. So maybe the feeling's the same. I just learned how to express it differently over the years. When I got out of college, as Elizabeth said, I got a job at the Village Voice, and I was very excited. I used to worship the music writers. They talk about hip-hop. what they called, you know, sort of post-punk music, and it was my dream to sort of work there, so I was very excited, and I got a job in the book section. And basically, whenever you work at the Village Voice, whatever came after you is when it went downhill. So if you worked there in 58 with, like, Norman Mailer, you know, and you left in 62, that was the heyday, and everything else was crap. If you were there in the 70s, and you're covering, like, the rise of CBGBs, and you were there till like, 81 before you got your job at New York Magazine or New Yorker, everything after that was crap. So I was there from, like, 91 to 96, and it was so good. And it's so sad how it's gone downhill since then. But I was very excited to work there. I was assistant in the book section, and I had to open the books every day. We got, like, 40 books a day in from publishers. And I really sort of was introduced to how capricious the whole reviewing process is, because if you wanted a book, one of the people who worked there would just take it home, and it wouldn't get reviewed. I was just an assistant, but if I wanted a book, I would take it home, and that person would not, you know, get a review in the paper. It was, like, sort of sad and maddening. And now that I'm on the other side, I'm sort of shamed, I guess. But the good thing about The Voice is that you could start writing. So I did get my first gig writing a TV review, and that led to other reviews. And I learned to write under deadline, and I guess when I was in college, I started handing in papers late, and some sort of passive-aggressive rebellion against something, because no one really paid attention, so it was sort of useless. But I learned to, like, sit down and sit down for 5 hours and hand things, you know, articles in on time. So I was trying to keep the lights on and buy a beer. So it was really helpful. And eventually, I felt confident enough to start writing fiction. And because I was writing book and film and TV reviews and writing about black imagery and pop culture, my first book was very sort of theory heavy. And I decided to write about a Gary Coleman-esque child star who gets very, you know, we pick him up 10 years later, he's been very debased, and he has a sort of loser existence in New York. And I could talk about the black child, the miracle child, like Stevie Wonder, Gary Coleman, and then like what happens to them when they grow up. And it was very interesting to me. I was talking about pop culture, various theories. And I think more importantly, I wasn't writing about myself. I was writing about this weird character. So I was avoiding the autobiographical first novel. I figured everybody writes the autobiographical first novel, so I shouldn't do that. I should be different and write a novel about a Gary Coleman-esque child star, who's, I guess in the book, the name of the show he's on is called I'm Movin' In, with an exclamation point over the move-in, because it seemed like in the 70s, all the sitcoms had like apostrophes. So, like, different strokes or what's happening. So I'm Movin' In made sense. And I was able to interrogate class and race, and it was very, very intense. And I got an agent, and I was very excited. And then we started hearing back from people. And I was quite surprised that a book about the failed career of a Gary Coleman-esque child star would fail to find its footing in the marketplace. The rejection slips began to pile up, and I started to have sort of very bizarre thoughts. When I first became aware of Top 40 radio, it was during the late 70s, so that meant a lot of disco. The Bee Gees, Diana Ross, and Donna Summer. And for years, I tried to understand what the song MacArthur Park was about. I grew up on the Donna Summer version. Perhaps you like the Richard Harris version with his bold Irish accent. I don't know. It wasn't until I started getting all those rejection letters, as I sat around in my underwear watching Jerry Springer with the shades drawn, surrounded by Budweiser cans, that I finally got what the song was about. MacArthur Park is an investigation of the artist's journey. I'd gone to a lot of trouble gathering ingredients, and when I was done, someone left the cake out in the rain. All the sweet green icing was flowing down. I didn't think that I could take it. Because it took so long to bake it. And I would never, ever, ever, ever have that recipe again. Knopf Publishing Group, why did you leave my cake out in the rain? Houghton Mifflin, Why did you leave my cake out in the rain? Atlas Vanity Publishing of Secaucus, New Jersey. Why did you not even return my phone calls? That was so weird. So maybe I thought I wasn't cut out for this writing thing, and I tried to consider what else I could do, what other occupations. My parents were of that generation that if you were an able-bodied black person, it was your duty to make something of yourself, uplift the race, become a lawyer or a doctor, an accountant. Those professions weren't up my alley, so I tried to think of what else I might be able to do. And at this point, I call your attention to my slender, delicate fingers and thin, feminine wrists. I bring them up not out of shame, but to point out certain fundamental realities of my existence. Far from feeling shame, in fact, I'm quite delighted with myself these days. We stand at the threshold of an important moment in our nation's history when a skinny black man with slender fingers and thin feminine wrists might actually become president. So I think if there was ever a time in history to be a skinny black man with thin feminine wrists, this is probably it. But back to my hands, okay? These are hands that say pianist, hand model, surgeon. Were these professions I might be suited for? Could I play the piano? As Elizabeth said, the first purchase I got when I got a real paycheck was buying an ergonomic chair. I slouch, I can't type, I hunt and peck. When I was writing my first book, I had to pop Advil all day because my neck was all messed up from being hunched over. So how could I sit on a piano bench without armrests and lumbar supports? I could not be a pianist. And on paper, being a hand model must be the life. You get free watches, free hand cream. You travel a lot, meet interesting people of the international jet set. But I had a very conservative upbringing. How could I indulge in the hand model lifestyle? I read People, Us Weekly. So that was out. Then it was a surgeon. I was all set to go to med school, head on down there and sign up, or whatever you do. And then I heard about how long operations are. You have to stand on your feet for like 10, 15, 20 hours straight. What if you have to go to the bathroom? I kept thinking about that. What if you have to go to the bathroom? And half the reason I got into the writing business was so I could sit on my ass all day. So then I started to think about it scientifically. The average book of literary fiction sells like 5,000 copies. 5,000 copies if you're lucky. Now assume that everyone loves the book, doesn't just throw it into the trash in disgust, and in addition makes 10 other people read it who also love it. Let's say this book has 50,000 readers, 50,000 people who love it. But there are 4.5 billion people in the world. You've made an impact in the lives of 0.00, a lot more zeros, 0.01% of the population. You're not even a gnat trying to get the attention of an elephant. You're a microbe in the butt of a gnat trying to get the attention of an elephant. And I know there's some budding writers in the audience, so but don't worry, I just pulled the 5,000 number, you know, out of the air. I was trying to Google the number before I got here, but it didn't work out. I know I'm not supposed to use Google as much as I do. I'm supposed to go to the library and, like, open books. And Google's digitizing all the books in the Library of Congress, and one day we're going to stop reading books on paper. But I can't help it, because I want Google for everything. I want a Google superego. Like, when I'm out drinking and I'm like, maybe I'll have one more beer, my Google superego will go, did you mean go home right now? Or I'm sitting around and I'm like, oh, there's a 10-hour Project Runway marathon on Bravo. I think I'll watch it. And superego will go, did you mean read a book and tell your family how much you love them? I think it'd be very useful. So where was I? The population of the Earth is very intimidating. Well, what about life on other planets, you might rightly ask. Perhaps there is life on other planets, and they have a taste for language poetry, creative nonfiction, and coming-of-age novels. Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but scientists say that the nearest planet outside our solar system is 10.5 light years away. That's pretty far. The chance of one of our Earth scientists coming up with a faster-than-light drive in our lifetime is quite slim. And estimates about the possibility of life on other planets vary. Some say that only 1 in 100 million planets is capable of supporting life. And what's the chance that they would like your stuff anyway? They could be all about the haiku up there. So you're out of luck. And I got very depressed thinking about all this. And then I thought, maybe it's out of my hands. Maybe I have no choice. A friend of mine is a real jerk. He has some fine qualities, but there's no escaping that he's a real jerk sometimes. And for years I've wondered just how he came to be such a jerk. And then one day it occurred to me, it was evolution. For generations, jerks have been breeding with other jerks to produce more jerks, who in turn breed other jerks who have litters of jerks in turn. It must have started thousands of years ago when some Neanderthal jerk got together with another Neanderthal jerk in a cave. Perhaps they met while fighting over a piece of gazelle, and then just clicked, you know, started talking about the weather. Oh, Glug Glug the Thunder God is quite angry today, don't you think? Yeah, you're right. Just chemistry like that. And they took it from there. And they had a child. And their jerk kid got together with another Neanderthal jerk, or Neanderthal of a similar type, a moron or a douche. And they had a kid who was half jerk, half douche, and so on for millennia. More or less breeding and concentrating unpleasant qualities, herding all that negative DNA together, until my friend was born. I figure it's the same with writers. The artistic temperament must go back just as far. There was a Neanderthal who paused while beating in the skull of a Neanderthal from the next cave over, and he thought to himself, hunting, gathering, gathering and hunting. Is that all there is to this miserable life? And he became the first Neanderthal existentialist. And he found a Neanderthal of melancholy temperament, a Neanderthal female who liked to draw non-representational doodles on the cave wall. And she was the first abstract artist, which upset the more traditional cave painters who were all realists into their stick figures and oxen, but what are you going to do? Then they had a kid who didn't like to hunt and gather, but tell stories all day. And he found a suitable mate, and so on throughout the centuries, spawning moody, arty kids. In the 1600s, one villager says to another, hey, did you see that new puppet show last night? And the artistic villager says, no, I don't watch puppet shows. I don't even own a puppet show set. I only listen to NPR. And so on to the present day, all that artistic DNA surviving, getting together. And as I sat in my dirty studio apartment watching Jerry Springer, indeed relating too deeply to Jerry Springer, I realized that maybe I was a recipient of all that sit-on-your-ass, muse-about-crap-all-day DNA. It didn't matter that no one liked what I was doing. I had no choice. So I got back to work. It went better next time, and now we come to the present. I live in Brooklyn. I moved there 14 years ago because it was cheap. It was a little embarrassing because I was raised in Manhattan, so I was a little bit of a snob about the other boroughs. But it was cheap, and I grew to love it, and it's my home. As you know, all the writers live in Brooklyn these days. Zsumpa Lahiri, Paul Auster, Nicole Krauss, Jonathan Safran Foer, many, many others. It's the place to be. You're simply not a writer if you don't live there. In fact, the physical act of moving your possessions from Manhattan to Brooklyn is now the equivalent of a 2-year MFA program. When you get to the other side, they give you 2 moleskin notebooks and a copy of Blogging for Dummies, and you're good to go. I have a hard time understanding all the hype. It's just a place. It doesn't have magical properties. In interviews, I get asked a lot, what's it like to write in Brooklyn? I get asked to do panels with other Brooklyn writers to discuss what it's like to be a writer in Brooklyn. It's like being a writer in Manhattan, except it takes longer to get to my shrink appointment. It's like being a writer in Paris, except there are more 24-hour bodegas. you sort of have to do these trade-offs. What do they think goes on? The magic fumes of the Brooklyn Queens Expressway open up the mind to mythical realms. Thank you, Henry Moses. Whenever I get writer's block, I take a swim in the cool, glowing waters of the Gowanus Canal. And the metaphors come rushing back. Your hair falls out, but that's the price you have to pay for artistic creation. A lot of my writer friends live in Brooklyn, and that makes people think we just sort of hang around with each other in cafes, trading work and discussing literature and whatnot. But I rarely see them, because we're home working, and we're sitting on a couch, being depressed, trying to get work done. I think the only Brooklyn-like thing about writing is when it resembles the movie The Warriors. I'm not sure if you've seen that. You got to battle the other gangs, the Gramercy Riffs, the Orphans, the Lizzies, with knives, bike chains, and baseball bats in order to bring it back home to Coney Island at the end of the night. In other words, it's hard, and that's when writing in Brooklyn is like writing. But if I don't understand the hype, I do appreciate I've gotten a lot of good stuff done there, so I'm grateful. And eventually I got comfortable enough in my new home to get around to writing the autobiographical fourth novel. So it was a big change for me. I just finished it a few days ago, so I'm sort of happy. I've had a lot of oddball premises in my books. I think it goes back to like all the stuff I read when I was a kid. I liked the tweaked reality, creating the rules of the off-kilter world, and it, you know, for a long time it allowed me to keep myself out of my work. I'm not an elevator inspector or a junketeering journalist. I'm certainly not John Henry. And I don't work in corporate branding. So I'm not sure why I avoided the autobiographical first novel. I assume because I didn't want to talk about myself. I think that probably changed after 9/11. I started writing about the city and trying to figure out how I could live in my hometown. And I wrote a lot of sort of personal pieces about that. And I think that was sort of helpful. When I wrote that sort of those book of essays about the city, I had been working on Apex Hides the Hurt, and I had to put it down to work on the New York essays. And when I came back to Apex, I didn't sort of like that character anymore. He was really sort of in control of everything and a little too cynical like some other characters I'd done. So I had to go back and sort of retrofit a lot of the book to my new idea of what I wanted my characters to do. And then when that book was done, I started writing a book about Sag Harbor, Long Island, which is a place I used to go in the summer growing up. It's in the Hamptons. It was a small town in the Hamptons that was wasn't really discovered until like the last 20 years or so. And there's like the White Hamptons and a little black sort of bubble in Sag Harbor. And the black middle class professionals started going out there in the 40s because they were allowed in places like the real sort of Hamptons, Bridgehampton, East Hampton, and the Jersey Shore. And so I grew up going out, living in Manhattan and going out to Sag Harbor in the summer and having adventures with like my friends. So I figured I would finally start writing about that. That's like the whole book, basically. That's the setting is the book. There's no plot. Nothing actually happens in the book. Which I think is actually more realistic. It takes place over the course of a summer. And how much smarter are you at the end of the summer than you were at the beginning? Like 0.01%. It's not because something big happened. It's because of a series of small things. In a more conventional novel about teenagers or coming-of-age novel, something big happens that tests the character and they grow. Like in the book when the two boys are on the tree and then one slips accidentally and the other one has to come to a separate piece about it, whatever that one's called. Like that. In my book, like the KKK doesn't come and like lynch somebody and they have to go on the run. He doesn't witness a murder. In chapter 7, he gets his braces off. That's like a big thing. But that's pretty much it. So the other thing that you find in a lot of coming-of-age novels is a really sort of clever teenager. And I sort of hate that. Sometimes people will get around that problem of having a very articulate teenager by making them sort of hyper-intelligent and a prodigy. But I was like really sort of stupid when I was 15 and not very articulate. So I really don't like that precocious teenager in fiction. I never really took to Catcher in the Rye. Like, looking back, if we just gave Holden Caulfield like some Prozac and an Xbox, you know, I think he'd be better off and we could save a lot of trouble. There's also a lot of pop culture in the book. I've always had an anxiety about easy pop cultural references, but it's about 85, and so how do I really avoid it? So I'm trying to use it to illuminate character, not to sort of name-check things. There's the case of the members-only jacket. It's a testament to the members-only jacket that it's survived so long as a wretched cultural signifier. But is it too easy a reference? When I was 8, when I was 15, I did make a lot of jokes about members-only jackets, and we all did. So how do you keep how do you be truthful to these sort of things and not be too easy? So in the piece, I'm going to read from the book, and there's a members-only reference, and hopefully it works. It's part of a dissection of teenage cursing. There actually is a bunch of curse words, so and hopefully it's a Richard Pryor, George Carlin type of inquiry into curse words and their power. Or not. It's sort of a generational portrait, and there's the question of the who cares about generational portraits? I generally don't. You know, when I started writing in the 90s, it was the rise of the Gen X identity, and you'd have people write things like, you know, where were you when Kurt Cobain died? You know, I love Nirvana, but was it really sort of our generation's 9/11? I think we need some proportion. And it's not just our, it's not just my generation, you know. I certainly loathe the self-mythology of the baby boomers. Last year was the 40th anniversary of the Summer of Love, and the Whitney Museum had all these posters around town for an exhibit on the art of the Summer of Love. I didn't actually go to see it, but I knew it was there because I'd seen it so many times before. The narrator goes, "It was a time of hope and change." And then there's like a film of a woman with long hair with a daisy, and she's wearing a leather fringe vest, and she's sort of hip-hop dancing around, and the music comes on, Jefferson Airplane. "One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small." So we've been celebrating the anniversary of the Summer of Love for 40 years, every year. It's ridiculous. We've been celebrating it since like Labor Day 1967. Wasn't last week great? Yeah, it was. "And the pills that mother gives you." So I'm trying to figure that out in the book. How long do we have to celebrate the Summer of Love? Well, you know, the boomers control the means of cultural production, and they can celebrate the Summer of Love as long as they want to. Until a generation that grew up in the 70s, 80s, and 80s takes over, and we can go on about the Summer of 77 and how great Star Wars was and how it changed the world forever and pop rocks. So I'm trying to talk about my generation, and hopefully that there's something interesting to say. It's sort of like the early days of hip-hop before it became really commercial and gangsterized, where the big singles were these corny songs like Roxanne, Roxanne. So I had a lot of fun sort of writing about that, and anyway, I was going to read a bit from it. It takes place in the summer. The sort of semi-premise is that the parents are in the town Monday through Friday, and they leave the kids out there left to their own devices during the week. And the narrator's named Benji. He has a brother named Reggie, and they're alone during the week. Their friends come over. Randy's an older kid who's sort of weird, but he has a car and can buy beer, so they hang out with him. There's a kid named Bobby. There's a kid named NP. NP's a nickname. It stands for "nigga please," because no matter what comes out of his mouth, the most appropriate response is "nigga please." So they call him NP for short. There's a reference to garanimals. I'm sure you know garanimals are mix and match separates for children. And they take the brain work out of dressing your kids. There's a visual aid.
Okay.
So they're in Benji's house. Bobby and NP are hanging out waiting for Randy to pick them up to take them to the beach. And NP has just asked if he can have a Coke. "You want sprinkles with that Coke?" Bobby asked. NP had a job at Johnny Waffle, the new ice cream joint in town. And whenever we went to visit him for freebies, we taunted him over the stupid shit he had to say all day. "Whip on top, waffle cone, slob your knob." "Shut up, you pleather members only wearing motherfucker," NP said, which might appear to be a non sequitur, as Bobby was wearing a t-shirt and shorts, but there is history there, context. It was a reference to some intel from Clive, who told us that he'd run into Bobby during the school year and described how Bobby was wearing a windbreaker that looked suspiciously like a knockoff members only jacket. No small misdemeanor, that. The trend that summer, insult-wise, was toward grammatical acrobatics, the unlikely collage. One smashed a colorful and an evocative noun or proper noun into a pejorative, gluing them together with an in-verb. I'm not sure of the syntactical parentage of the in-verbs, so I'll just call them the in-verbs. Verbal noun, gerund-like creature, cog in the adjectival machine. Who knew? As was the case with some of the people in my living room, there's a little uncertainty in the bloodlines. Lookin' was a common in-verb, like so. So here you have the modifier, the in-verb, and the object. In this case, the modifiers are Angela Davis, Gorbachev, George Jefferson. The in-verb is looking, and the objects are motherfucker, bitch, nigger. So if you're going to create an insult out of this array, you'd go, "You Angela Davis looking motherfucker," if they had like a big afro or something. "You Gorbachev looking bitch," if they had like a birthmark. And then "you George Jefferson looking nigga," and so on. You could mix and match. "Wearing" was a common in-verb also. So in this example, we have a modifier, in-verb, object again. Messed up garanimal ass. 99-cent gold chain. Fake Adidas. The in-verb is wearing. And the objects again, motherfucker, bitch, nigger. So if you're going to make an insult out of this array, you'd go, "You messed up garanimal ass wearing motherfucker. You 99-cent gold chain wearing bitch. You fake Adidas wearing nigga," and so on. You could also preface things with a throat clearing, "You fucking," as in, "You fucking Chaka from Land of the Lost looking motherfucker." Directed at Bobby, for example, who had light brown skin, light brown hair, and indeed shared these characteristics with the hominid sidekick on the Saturday morning adventure show, The Land of the Lost. "You fucking" acted as a rhetorical pause, allowing the speaker a few extra seconds to pluck some splendid modifier out of the invective ether and giving the listener a chance to gird himself for the top-notch put-down/splendid imagery to follow. True masters of the style sometimes attached the nonsensical "with your monkey ass" as a kicker to convey sincerity and depth of feeling. Hence, "You fucking Kunta Kinte looking motherfucker with your monkey ass." You may have noticed that the in-verbs were generally visual. The heart of the critique concerned what you were putting out into the world, the vibes you gave off, which is what made them so devastating when executed well. This ordinance detonated in the area between you and the mirror, between you and what you thought everyone else was seeing. "You hear that?" I asked. There was a loud squeaking noise. It was Marcus on that messed up bike of his. You heard him changing gears 2 miles away. We all sighed with relief. Marcus was a key player in that he reassured us that there was someone else more unfortunate than ourselves. He possessed three primary mutant powers. We'd all seen them in action. One, he was able to attract to his person all the free-floating derision in the vicinity through a strange magnetism. Two, he bent light waves, rendering the rest of us invisible to bullies. When Marcus was present, the big kids were incapable of seeing us, picking on him exclusively, delivering noogies, knuckle punches, and Indian rope burns to his waiting flesh. Indian rope burns always put an end to the torture because we all got distracted while bonding over our smidgen of Indian blood, 1/8, 1/16, Seminole, whatever, and that was that. Three, superior olfactory capability. We heard his bike from 2 miles away. He smelled barbecue from twice that distance, attaining such mastery that he could ascertain with the faintest nostril quivering if the stuff on the grill had just been thrown on or was about to come off, and he acted accordingly. Like a knife and fork, he appeared around dinner time. I think it was a summer or two when he ate over every night, guzzling high C and waving a plastic-coated paper plate around for seconds, more. Not until later did I wonder why there was no dinner at his house, why no one missed him at twilight. Call him a mooch to hurt his feelings, and he'd just smile, wipe his mouth with his wrist, and snatch the last piece of chicken, probably a wing, damn him. He was always hungry like we all were, but at least he had the good sense to eat. Marcus pried open the glass doors. They were sticky. Decades of sand filled their tracks. What's up? He had his beach towel around his neck, and he wore dark green and gray plaid shorts. He extended his hand to Bobby, and I witnessed a blur of choreography. Yes, the new handshakes were out, shaming me with their permutations and slippery routines. Slam, grip, flutter, snap. Or was it slam, flutter, grip, snap? I was all thumbs when it came to shakes, devised in the underground soul laboratories of Harlem, pounded out in the blacker-than-thou sweatshops of the South Bronx. The new handshakes always had me faltering in embarrassment. Like this? No, you didn't stick the landing. The judges give you a 4.6. No one ever commented on my fumbles, though, and I was grateful. I had all summer to get it right, unless someone went back to the city and returned with some new variation that spread like a virus, and which my strong dork constitution produced countless antibodies against. NP slapped Marcus's hand. Hey, act, NP began, before cutting himself off. He was about to use last year's nickname. We used to call Marcus Arthur Ashe. Two summers before, Marcus had suffered a dry patch, actually multiple dry patches, on his elbows and knees, in the webbing between his fingers and toes. Why does mother let him out the house like that, we'd always wonder, but never say aloud, because talking about someone's mother was, well, talking about someone's mother. Talking about someone's mother was talking about your own mother. It opened a door. Obviously, the nickname affected him deeply. Perhaps the sight of a tennis racket mortifying him all those long months of the school year, or a chance encounter with someone dressed in crisp white clothing curdling his mood. All I know is that the next year, next summer, Marcus returned so profoundly moisturized that there was nary a flake of ash to be seen on his skin. In fact, his skin was so lubed up that he glistened mightily whenever the sun hit his flesh, and even when it didn't. He had become, sadly, a living Jerry Curl. Hey, activator, NP called out one afternoon while making little spritzing motions around his head. And Arthur Ashe was now activator until Labor Day. It was the last week of June, still early in the season, so there's no telling what kind of nickname he'd get this year. Whatever it was likely to be of a kinder variety. He'd grown 4 inches over the year and started lifting weights, or tied together phone books, some kind of heavy object. Perhaps he'd cast his disappointments in lead. No one had put him to the test yet, but powwows over the matter, even our diluted 1/8 or 1/16 powwows, decided he could kick all our asses, and we had it coming. I did a head count. There are 4 of us here, Randy and Clive on the way. 5 seats in the car. They're not here yet? Bobby sucked his teeth, waiting on them all day. It's going to be dark by the time they get here. It's going to be 6 of us, I asked. I was trying to get the fight started over who was coming in the car. Let everyone get their arguments for inclusion going beforehand and see where I stood. Shit, I know I'm going. I had to ride my bike last time, Marcus said. I know I'm going. He's my cousin, NP said. I decided to make some lunch to fortify myself for the battle to come. Reggie and me didn't agree on much when it came to food, but we were both partial to Campbell's home-style chicken soup with egg noodles. It was the Cadillac of canned soup, the noodles firm yet pliant on the tongue, the ratio of celery and carrot bits consistent and reliable. The tiny amber globules of fat shimmered on the surface in an enticing display to delight the eye. There was one can left. I traded it with Reggie that morning for a bag of Lay's potato chips and two ice cream sandwiches. Every couple of days, me and Reggie walked over to Federico's and stocked up on food. Our family had a credit account there. Everybody had their brands. Black kids, white kids, Sperry, Gerbeau, Benetton, Lee jeans, La Tigre polos. According to the plumage theory of social commerce, if the correct things belong to you, perhaps you might belong. I was more survival-oriented. The brands I worshipped lived in the soup aisle in the freezer section behind glass. I'm talking frozen food here. Swanson's, of course, was the standard, the elegant marriage of form and function. The four food groups, meat, veg, starch, apple cobbler, lay pristine in their separate foil compartments, which were, in fact, presto, a serving dish, meal and plate in one slim rectangle. This was American ingenuity at its best and most sustaining. Fried chicken, turkey, Salisbury steak, that was 3 days of the week right there. But all hail Stouffer's, pure royalty, their bright orange packaging a beacon in refrigerator sections across the NY metro area. French bread pizzas, so continental. Turkey cetrazzini, chicken pot pie, beef pot pie, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Stouffer's employed the best minds the prepackaged food industry had to offer, no doubt luring geniuses from rival firms with groovy perks and extensive benefit packages, ultimately producing that sublime boil-in-bag technology, up there with penicillin and a microchip in the pantheon of 20th century scientific achievement. I will admit to an unwholesome fascination with boil-in-bag technology. Chicken a la king, Swedish meatballs, beef stroganoff with parsley noodles. It was satisfaction itself that oozed out of the plastic bags and murked our waiting bowls. There were as well renegades to whom we'd given our hearts, like Howard Johnson's tender sweet fried clams, 95% batter plus a special ingredient that made you forget they were 95% batter. The next time you reach for them in a supermarket, and the rare and valued Weight Watchers chicken cutlet and vegetable medley, tough to find on account of some complex distribution quirk beyond my ken, and entering our menu rotation by accident. My mother had bought a box for herself one time, and in a famished episode, I devoured it and became addicted. I felt ridiculous buying a Weight Watchers meal. The sight of the pink box sliding across the scanner, rousing my sundry manhood issues. The gentle ping of the barcode reader becoming in my mind a gigantic church bell ding-donging my worthlessness throughout Food Emporium and beyond the entire zip code. But there was no denying that tantalizing breading on a cutlet, featuring a blend of spices so well calibrated for delight that it was hard to accept that it had been squirted on by machine. For surely, this was human tenderness and love of craft before you. And the orange butter sauce, yes, the orange butter sauce. More of a chutney, really, covering the veg medley. Believe this one truth in my story, if nothing else. Thank you. I have questions from the audience. Do you have any special intuitive powers? Weirdly, I have like a really low affect a lot of the time, which has really served me well in poker games. And so instead of like people, like I only read people, but people get nervous because they can't read me. And so it looks like they think I'm looking into their soul when I play poker with them sometimes. So, the answer is no, but I have low affect. Is it true that you don't like desserts? Yes, it is true. I worked in an ice cream store for 3 summers out in Sag Harbor, and I would just eat ice cream all day for breakfast, for lunch and dinner if I had like an evening shift, for breakfast and lunch if I had like a morning shift. And every day I would get sick. I'm not throwing up, but I would be so, you know, full and feel ill. And the next day I would start over again. And this went on for 3 summers, and now I hate ice cream. I hate dessert. And then people are always trying to, you know, I go to people's houses and they're like, oh, have some of the cobbler I made. And then, like, I say no, and I have to tell the story again, and everyone, you know, it's just like, everyone's just like, grow up. you seem to come up with ideas for your novels in interesting places. How do you decide which ideas to write about and which to discard? I guess if they stick around with me, you know, I read an article about the naming of Prozac in the New York Times magazine, like in '96. And then 4 years later, I was like, oh, corporate naming is sort of interesting, and it stayed with me. So I have a few ideas and generally when I finish something, I have like two or three things I can work on, and then I have to decide which one I want to work on next. And generally the one I end up thinking about is the one I sort of obviously, I have like a notebook, and if I keep taking notes on one idea and like always like there's only one sentence on the other idea, then it's sort of obvious. I have a few things, now I have a few things that have been sort of kicking around, and now that I'm done with this book, I'm not sure what to work on next, and I'm sure it'll just be like the same process, whatever I keep thinking about over time is what I'll work on next. You've written a lot about interesting slash unusual jobs. What's an interesting job you'd like to try for a day? Would it be fun to like be like one of those Disneyland characters, like in a Goofy costume? Or is that just like a weird fetish? I've been thinking about this like twice in the last week. I think I have some kind of weird fetish developing. So, I don't know. How do you balance your work with your family life? I'm one of these writers who, you know, have the whole day to myself in order to get stuff done. If I have a doctor's appointment at 1 o'clock, I don't start working because I know I have to stop. And when I get back at 2:30, I'm like, oh, the whole day's shot. So I just watch CNN. So, and then you hear about the woman who has like 3 kids, and she writes from like 4:30 a.m. to 5:30 a.m. and then gets up with them, and then she gets a book on Oprah later on. But I can't do that. I need like the whole day. So my daughter's 3, and when she was born, I had to become like that person who writes for an hour. I did that for like a few months when I was finishing Apex, and I'll never do it again. It was so crazy. And also, she couldn't walk then, so now she can walk and she can come in. So I didn't work for like a year and a half, and I was just sort of like, it was nice hanging out, you know, with her and being one of these like cliched like Brooklyn dads who, with no visible means of support, who's always at the playground. So I didn't get any work done, but I wouldn't sort of trade that, you know. But eventually I had to get back to work, so we had to sort of figure out how I could have my whole days, you know, my full days again. So, you know, I think it's always a struggle to find your writing time, whether you have a full-time job, part-time job, responsibilities that are more important, you know, than work sometimes. So I think that always goes on. When Calvin Trillin was here, he told a story about taking visitors to see the tic-tac-toe playing chicken in Chinatown. What New York site do you like to show off to out-of-towners? Well, I guess if my living room qualifies as a site, that's generally what they see, because we never go anywhere when I have friends come to see me. When I used to go to a lot more bars, there was like I would take them to like the one bar. But I guess nowhere, because I don't really take people around. There's a question, do you get Cyndi Lauper? There are people I love and hate, and over like the course of like 25 years, I generally like everybody I used to hate. Like, I used to hate, like, who's the guy in 24, the main guy? Kiefer Sullivan, because, like, he was, like, a pretty boy, and all the girls liked him in high school. And then, like, but I like 24, and he's like, you know, he kept working, and, like, well, he's just making a living, trying to pay the mortgage, why not? Cindy Lauper, you know, she got really obnoxious for a couple years there, but I don't know, I see her on TV, and she seems kind of cool. You know, everyone's just trying to make a living and get by. Have you ever considered appearing on stage painted blue with an ostrich feather headdress? Well, the feathers remind me of my burgeoning fetish of, like, costuming. Perhaps my outfit at Disney World could be, like, a feathered thing, a big bird thing. My fetish is really taking shape here tonight, so thank you. Thank you for that question. Today I Googled you and would like to have you discuss the YouTube clips on your website. Being a baby boomer, it went over my head. So, you know, I have, like... There's too many pills. You got to cut back on those pills. I have a website because, like, my agent, someone, like, actually took her domain name, her name for a domain name, and held it hostage unless she would represent him. And so she was like, to all the authors, you know, get your domain name and your website. So I have, like, you know, whatever basic information on my website. If I have a reading, I'll put it up there. And I've had it for like 3 years, and it's so lonely because I have nothing to put up there. So periodically I'll throw up some kind of weird non sequitur headline with like a YouTube clip. And recently I've been taking like Sesame Street clips, like... That I find and put them up there. They don't mean anything. I just seem so lonely. Please describe one of your favorite sentences, moments, or scenes in one of your novels, and tell us why you like it. There are definitely, you know, sentences I hate, because they're like just like declarative or just for exposition, and like it took a long time to get, you know, figure out how to say, you know, the bank was granite, it was old, you know, just like this boring crap. You have to, you know, but you have to say it sometimes. Describe the building, describe the hands, describe the person. So there's definitely sentences I hate because I know I put them off to like the last minute, and then, you know, I still despise them. My favorite sentences are like new sentences. Like, there'll be a point in the book where suddenly like this new sentence popped up, like something I've never done before, and it's like I'm doing some kind of weird comma thing, or like, you know, putting some like enlivening some kind of weird noun in a new way, and I'm like, wow, like I couldn't do that the year before, and just suddenly it happened. I sort of like had some kind of weird perceptual leap, or I learned how to like cut adjectives or something, you know, like some kind of, so there are times like when I'll look back over something like, oh yeah, I remember that day when I came up with that crazy sentence, and I'll feel really sort of happy about that day. I'm not joking, that's really, it's true. It's true. If you were a TV critic now, what would you most like to write about, or a particular show or trend? You know, I was paid so little at the Village Voice, and I had to write, you know, for money, that I'm so bitter about being a critic that I really like being a complete consumer of television now, and not having theories or anything like that. I don't have to justify my love for, you know, The Wire or whatever. But you know, TV shows I like, The Wire, I like 24. You know, though it always goes downhill like halfway through the season. But you always forget, and you go back. It's like the fried clams. You always forget, and you just go back to them each time. Because of the writer's strike, I've started watching like more reality TV. So I hope they clear that up soon. Do you agonize over your sentences? Yeah, you know, sometimes some will come out sort of semi-perfect or doable and, you know, works fine. And then sometimes it takes like, you know, it's not years, like you're not thinking about it for years, but you write it and then you figure out how to move something around 6 months later. And then like 6 months later after that, you realize how to move something else. You take out the semicolon because that doesn't work. So, I mean, so that, you know, the senses evolve over years, you know, it's harsh. What types of role models were influential to you growing up or early in your writing career? I was like, sort of, I wasn't really big on mentors or anything like that. Well, they weren't big on me, I guess, is the more appropriate thing. So, you know, I talked about, like, reading biographies of, like, Joyce, and he was a sickly child. I really liked Misery. I really like biographies of artists who go through a lot of misery. Like Beckett, he had all these, like, psychosomatic boils and whatnot, and everyone hated his stuff. He wrote this kind of, like, Finnegan's Wake-type early novellas, which sounded horrible. And then he was like, World War II broke out, and he was like in the French Resistance, like in the mountains, like blowing up stuff and writing, you know, his first novels. And like, what a life. That's crazy. That totally sucked. So when I was like starting to write, I found those stories really inspirational because, you know, I was just sort of broke, and, you know, it wasn't that bad. That's cerebral. Da, da, da. Da, da. I like that. I like the messy handwriting ones. This one, I can't even read that one. It's so messy. In John Henry Days, Pamela asked Jay what the J stood for. The main character goes by J, period. And this person's asking me to explain the final sentence of the novel. I can't do that, you know? I did all this work not to explain it, you know? I appreciate the question. I think I have... for me, it's really obvious, because it's not obvious, because people do ask me that occasionally. So I'm not sure what to say. I'm sorry. Early in your career, you were often compared to Ralph Ellison. How do you feel about that? I was really, you know, inspired by reading The Invisible Man in college, but when I was in seventh grade, we had an excerpt in one of these, like, short story anthologies, and they had the Battle Royale section that opens up the novel in there. And it was crazy, just the way he was sort of, it was very surreal. He was talking about race in a way I'd never seen before. It was very inspiring. I think, I think part of the critical apparatus now, like if you're kind of a weird black person, they're like, oh, you're very Ellisonian. It doesn't matter like what you're doing. If you're sort of like not doing what people expect of you, you're Ellisonian. Which I guess is all right. How do I feel about it? Well, you know, I just write this. I can only write, and then how it's received and the sort of whatever... how it's pigeonholed and talked about, I can't really control, and I don't really want to think about it. People ask me, like, do you have a lot of control over your covers? And, you know, I have input and I can veto stuff, but I actually don't care about the covers of my books. I worry about the stuff that's inside, and then, like, I feel like it's not my job to worry about what it looks like. I can only do, like, a certain amount of stuff. So... all that stuff is really sort of separate from what I really like to do and what makes me happy, which is actually writing and thinking up stuff. So I try to avoid thinking about it as much as possible. What was my major in college? I was an English major. It was a very conservative English department, so they didn't really teach anything after like 1945. So I had to find that stuff on my own. I mean, really, they did. And I met someone who teaches at Harvard now, And they were teaching The Intuitionist, and I was really flattered. And I was like, but how can you teach it? Because it came out in 99, and, you know, isn't that against the rules? And he said, well, it's the 21st century now, so it's like last century stuff. So it's okay to teach it. Do you ever wonder what would have happened if you'd gone to the writing class? Not really. I mean, it was really nice to be sort of embittered. Once you realize that no one particularly wants to help you that much, and you're sort of on your own. You're always on your own when you sit down to write. You know, no one else is going to put the words there for you. So, I think the sooner you realize that it's going to be a pretty horrible profession, it's really useful. And I think that's sort of it. I've really enjoyed myself, and I hope you enjoyed it too.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was poet Colson Whitehead. He spoke at Portland Arts and Lectures in 2008. Thank you for joining us for The Archive Project. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We have lots of other talks at our website. Listen to them all at literary-arts.org. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting, produced by Spencer Raymond. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thank you for joining us.